A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about Sun Tzu and Machiavelli, the two dead guys who show up in every business book, every startup pitch deck, and basically every LinkedIn post about strategy. The question is, what actually differentiates their philosophies, given they wrote in wildly different cultural contexts? And I think the thing hiding inside this prompt is the unspoken question. Why do we keep mashing them together as if they're two flavors of the same thing?
Because they're both quotable in 12 words or less, and that's catnip for people who want to sound strategic without doing the reading.
That's the hook. Two of the most cited strategic authorities in Silicon Valley boardrooms, and they fundamentally disagree on what strategy even is. And right now, with AI systems starting to make strategic decisions and geopolitical instability ramping up, the lazy Sun Tzu meets Machiavelli. Mashup is producing genuinely bad decisions.
It's not just sloppy scholarship, it's sloppy thinking that has consequences. You've got founders justifying toxic culture by citing Machiavelli, and consultants telling resource-strapped teams to win without fighting, while ignoring that Sun Tzu was talking about a very specific kind of conflict.
The episode is about pulling these two apart and looking at what each actually said in context so we can stop using them as interchangeable strategic seasoning.
The context could not be more different. Sun Tzu is writing somewhere around the 5th century BCE, during the Warring States period in China, seven major states locked in near-constant conflict but also deeply interdependent. The goal wasn't to annihilate your enemy, it was to win while preserving the system, because you were going to have to live next to these people afterward.
Whereas Machiavelli writes The Prince in 1513, after being tortured and exiled by the Medici family. His Italy is a patchwork of city-states getting invaded by France, Spain, the Holy Roman Empire. Mercenary armies switching sides mid-battle. Survival means outlasting people who want you dead.
The book wasn't even published until 1532, 5 years after he died. The man synonymous with calculated power moves never got to leverage his own treatise.
There's something almost Sun Tzu about that. The strategist who wins without ever seeing the victory. But that's exactly the kind of conflation we need to be careful about. Sun Tzu's ideal victory is winning without fighting at all. Starving a city into submission through superior logistics rather than storming the walls. Chapter 3 lays this out explicitly. The supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without battle.
Machiavelli's ideal victory looks completely different. His case study is Cesare Borgia in the Romagna in 1502. Borgia appoints a notoriously cruel minister to pacify a chaotic region. The minister restores order through brutality. Then Borgia has him publicly executed and displayed in the town square, cut in two pieces. The people are simultaneously grateful and terrified. That's the Machiavellian win. Calculated ruthlessness followed by calculated reputation management.
Already you can see the philosophical gap. Sun Tzu sees conflict as a problem to be solved with minimal cost. The ideal is to make conflict unnecessary through superior positioning, intelligence, and deception. Machiavelli sees conflict as a permanent condition of human society. You don't solve it. You manage it. And that management sometimes requires cruelty.
The word he uses is virtual. It doesn't translate neatly. It's not virtue in the moral sense. It's the ability to impose your will on fortune. Chapter 25 develops this most fully. Fortune is a river that floods and destroys, but a prudent prince builds dikes and canals in advance. Virtue is the quality that lets you shape events rather than be shaped by them.
That's where the deception piece gets interesting, because both authors talk about it extensively, but for completely different reasons. Sun Tzu treats deception as a neutral tool for efficiency. The famous line, "All warfare is based on deception," is from Chapter 1. It's not morally loaded. It's just the most efficient way to achieve your objective without wasting resources.
Machiavelli's treatment of deception in Chapter 18, On the Way Princes Should Keep Their Word, is much more uncomfortable. He says a prince should appear merciful, faithful, humane, and religious, but be ready to act otherwise when circumstances demand it. It's explicitly tied to reputation and the maintenance of power. The deception isn't about efficiency. It's about survival in a world where everyone else is also deceiving.
There's a line in that chapter that still lands like a punch. A prince must have no other objective than war and its rules and discipline. Not because war is good, but because if you're not prepared for it, you lose everything. That's a fundamentally different worldview from Sun Tzu's. The best general is the one who never needs to fight.
Both books are short. Dense, but short. Which is part of why they get reduced to quote collections. You can read either in an afternoon, but understanding them requires knowing the context they were responding to.
The Warring States period isn't just a backdrop. It's the operating system Sun Tzu is writing for. 7 states, all roughly matched in capability, all knowing they'll have to coexist after any given conflict. The goal isn't to eliminate the enemy. It's to win within a system that has to keep functioning.
Machiavelli's Italy is the opposite. It's fragmentation. City-states, papal forces, foreign powers sweeping through. There's no stable system to preserve. The question isn't, how do I win while keeping the system intact? It's how do I survive when the system is already broken?
That distinction gets completely lost when someone in a boardroom says, we need to be more Sun Tzu about this, or time to get Machiavellian. They're reaching for a vibe, not a framework.
The vibe usually ends up being some chimera. Sun Tzu's efficiency mixed with Machiavelli's ruthlessness, deployed to justify behavior that neither author would actually endorse if you read them carefully.
Let's go deeper on that toolkit difference. For Sun Tzu, winning isn't defeating the enemy. It's achieving your objective without the cost of battle. Chapter 3 lays out a hierarchy. The best policy is to attack the enemy's strategy. Next best is to attack their alliances, then their army, and the worst option is besieging walled cities. Actual combat is last.
Which is counterintuitive for a book called The Art of War. The ideal general wins by making battle unnecessary. You surround a city, cut supply lines, spread disinformation so their allies abandon them, and wait. The city falls without a single assault. Victory at zero marginal cost.
The mechanism for that is deception and intelligence. Strategy is essentially an information processing problem. If you know the enemy's dispositions, their supply situation, their commander's temperament, you can maneuver them into a position where fighting becomes irrational for them.
Machiavelli would find that naive. Not the intelligence part, he's all for knowing your enemy, but the idea that you can consistently win without fighting assumes a world where rational actors will concede when outmaneuvered. Machiavelli's world is full of actors who will burn everything down out of spite, pride, or sheer unpredictability.
That's where virtue comes in. Chapter 25 argues that fortune controls maybe half of human affairs, but the other half is up to free will. He compares fortune to a violent river. When it floods, it destroys everything. But you build dikes and canals when the weather's calm. The dikes aren't about avoiding the flood. They're about channeling it, surviving it, maybe even using it.
Preparation, for Machiavelli, includes the willingness to be cruel. Chapter 17 makes a distinction that still rattles people. Cruelty can be well used or badly used. Well used cruelty is done once, decisively, for the sake of security, and not repeated. Badly used cruelty grows over time. Borgia's execution of Ramiro de Orco is the model. One brutal act, then it's over, and order follows.
Sun Tzu has no equivalent to this. His cruelty is instrumental and impersonal. Execute the concubines to establish that orders are orders. There's no chapter on when to be cruel versus when to be clement, because cruelty isn't a strategic category for him. It's just a tool of command discipline.
That gets us to deception, where the contrast is sharpest. Sun Tzu's Chapter 1 line, "All warfare is based on deception," is followed by practical techniques. When you're capable, feign incapacity. When you're near, appear far. It reads almost like a field manual. Deception is a technique, like flanking or fortifying.
Machiavelli's Chapter 18 is something else entirely. He's talking about the prince's entire public persona. A prince should seem merciful, faithful, humane, and religious, but must know how to be the opposite when the state requires it. The deception isn't a battlefield tactic. It's an identity.
He grounds it in a pretty bleak anthropology. Men are ungrateful, fickle, false, cowardly, covetous. Therefore, a prince who keeps his word when it harms him will be destroyed by those who don't. The deception isn't optional. It's defensive.
Sun Tzu never makes that move. He doesn't ground deception in the theory of human nature. He grounds it in efficiency. Deception works because it conserves resources and avoids unnecessary destruction. It's not that people are evil. It's that direct confrontation is wasteful.
That's the fundamental disagreement. Sun Tzu's ideal world is one where strategy makes conflict obsolete. Machiavelli's world is one where conflict is permanent and strategy is how you survive it. One is a strategy of transcendence. The other is a strategy of endurance.
Which means the modern manager who says, I'm being Machiavellian, when they're actually just being efficient and avoiding conflict, has it exactly backward. Avoiding conflict is Sun Tzu. Machiavelli would tell you to confront the problem directly, decisively, and accept that people might hate you for it, as long as they don't hate you enough to act.
That philosophical gap doesn't stay in the library. It leaks into boardrooms, startups, and now even into the algorithms making strategic decisions. And the thing that gets me is how often the two get fused into something neither author would recognize.
The strategic chimera. Take Sun Tzu's efficiency, mix in Machiavelli's ruthlessness, and suddenly you've got a philosophy that justifies treating everyone terribly while claiming it's just good strategy.
Uber under Travis Kalanick is the textbook case. The aggressive expansion, the disregard for regulations, the internal culture, it got labeled Machiavellian constantly. But if you actually read Machiavelli, he's explicit that a prince who alienates the populace is doomed. Chapter 19 is basically a warning about not becoming hated. Kalanick's Uber didn't just make enemies of regulators, it made enemies of its own drivers and riders. That's not Machiavellian, that's just self-destructive.
It's anti-Machiavellian. Machiavelli's whole thing is that cruelty has to be calculated to secure your position, not indulged because it's convenient. Borgia executed one guy, publicly, and it worked because it was decisive and final. Uber's approach was death by a thousand PR crises. No chapter in The Prince covers how to recover from your own unforced errors.
Yet the label stuck because Machiavellian in popular usage just means ruthless. The nuance about popular support, about well-used versus badly used cruelty, all of that gets stripped out. What's left is a caricature that's more dangerous than the real thing, because it gives people permission to be cruel without being strategic about it.
The same flattening happens to Sun Tzu, but from the other direction. Everyone knows. Know your enemy and know yourself. But that's one line from Chapter 3. The five constant factors from Chapter 1. Moral influence, heaven, earth, command, and doctrine. Those are the actual framework. Moral influence means whether your people will follow you into difficulty. Heaven and earth are about timing and terrain. Command is about the general's qualities. Doctrine is about organization and logistics. That's a systems thinking framework. When you reduce it to know your enemy, you strip out the entire diagnostic apparatus.
The cultural blind spot here is that Western readers tend to interpret Sun Tzu through a Machiavellian lens by default. We assume deception must be about personal power because that's the framework we inherited. But Sun Tzu's deception isn't personal, it's systemic. You're not deceiving to aggrandize yourself, you're deceiving to conserve resources, to win without breaking the system you're trying to lead.
Which brings us to the practical question. When do you actually use which framework? Because they're not interchangeable, and picking the wrong one for your situation is worse than picking neither.
Sun Tzu's approach fits long-term positioning plays, especially when you're resource-constrained and can't afford direct confrontation. Think Apple's product strategy under Steve Jobs. They didn't try to outcompete Microsoft on enterprise software or outmanufacture Dell on cheap PCs. They positioned themselves in a completely different space. Design forward, integrated, premium, and let the competition fight over the scraps. That's win without fighting applied to business.
Whereas Amazon's marketplace strategy is much closer to Machiavelli. They use leverage ruthlessly. If you're a third-party seller, Amazon will compete with you, undercut you, and use your own sales data to do it. It's calculated. It's decisive. And it works because Amazon doesn't particularly care if sellers resent them, as long as customers keep buying. That's chapter 17. Logic. Be feared by sellers, loved by customers, and make sure the two groups don't overlap enough to become a problem.
The key is that Amazon can sustain that because they're in a position of dominance. Machiavelli's advice is for princes who already have power and need to keep it. If you're a startup trying to break into a market, playing Amazon's game gets you crushed. You don't have the leverage.
The diagnostic question is, are you in a Sun Tzu situation or a Machiavelli situation? Long-term positioning with room to maneuver. Short-term survival where you have to act decisively or lose everything. The mistake is trying to do both simultaneously, which usually means being ruthless without being strategic and calling it wisdom.
This is where the AI angle gets unsettling. Because when we build strategic AI systems, wargaming models, business simulation tools, supply chain optimizers, we're encoding one philosophy or the other, usually without realizing it.
A supply chain AI that's optimizing for efficiency and long-term resilience is Sun Tzu. It avoids confrontation with bottlenecks by routing around them. A pricing algorithm that's designed to crush competitors in a zero-sum marketplace is Machiavelli. It's using leverage decisively to eliminate threats.
Most of the engineers building these systems aren't sitting there thinking, which Renaissance philosopher am I encoding today? They're optimizing for whatever metric they've been given. But the metric itself implies a philosophy. That's Sun Tzu efficiency. Maximize market share at any cost. That's Machiavellian virtù applied to quarterly earnings.
The danger is when the system's philosophy doesn't match the actual strategic context. You deploy a Machiavellian pricing AI in a market where long-term relationships matter, and you've just automated your own reputational destruction. You deploy a Sun Tzu positioning AI in a crisis where you need to act now, and you've automated paralysis.
We're already seeing versions of this. The algorithmic trading systems that caused flash crashes, those were essentially Machiavellian AIs in Sun Tzu markets. They were optimized for zero-sum speed and leverage, but the market as a whole needs stability to function. When every actor is playing Borgia, the system breaks.
The Borgia approach works when one actor does it and everyone else doesn't. When it becomes the default strategy, you get what Machiavelli warned about in the discourses. A race to the bottom where nobody can trust anyone, and the whole system becomes ungovernable.
The people designing these systems need to be asking, what kind of world is this AI assuming it's operating in? Is it a world where conflict can be avoided through superior positioning? Or a world where conflict is permanent and must be managed through decisive action? Because those assumptions produce radically different behaviors, and the wrong assumption in the wrong context isn't just suboptimal, it's catastrophic.
Right now, nobody's asking that question. They're just grabbing whatever strategic framework sounds smart and feeding it into the optimization function.
If you're sitting there thinking, okay, how do I actually use this without becoming a caricature? Here's what to do.
First thing is the diagnostic. Before you reach for either author, figure out what kind of situation you're actually in. Is this a Sun Tzu scenario? Long-term positioning, resource constrained, room to maneuver, can afford to avoid direct confrontation. Or is this Machiavelli? Short-term survival, zero sum, you have to act decisively or lose the ground you've got.
The trap is that most people default to whichever author they're more comfortable quoting. The founder who's read three Sun Tzu quotes will frame every problem as a positioning challenge. The executive who likes feeling tough will frame every problem as a moment for calculated ruthlessness. Neither of them is actually diagnosing anything.
The diagnostic has to come first because the frameworks pull in opposite directions. Sun Tzu says avoid the fight if you can. Machiavelli says if the fight is inevitable, hit first and hit hard enough that you don't have to hit again. If you apply Sun Tzu to a Machiavelli situation, you get paralysis. If you apply Machiavelli to a Sun Tzu situation, you get unnecessary wreckage.
Second thing, read both books in full, not the quote collections, not the blog post summaries, the actual texts. They're both short. You can read The Art of War in an afternoon, The Prince in maybe two afternoons.
The reason this matters is that the popular extracts are systematically misleading. Everyone knows Chapter 3 of Sun Tzu. Know your enemy and know yourself. Almost nobody talks about Chapter 5, Energy, which is about momentum and timing. The idea that strategic advantage is like water flowing downhill. It builds force from shape, not from effort. That's a completely different insight than deception is good.
Machiavelli's chapter 17 is way more nuanced than the caricature. He doesn't say be cruel. He says, if you have to be cruel, do it once, do it decisively, and make sure it secures your position. The cruelty that grows over time, the repeated small cruelties, that's what destroys a prince. That's not the guy people quote when they're justifying a pattern of toxic behavior.
The popular Machiavelli is basically a permission structure for being awful. The actual Machiavelli is giving you a very specific cost-benefit analysis of when awfulness is strategically necessary and when it's self-defeating. Those are not the same thing.
Third insight. Build a framework that explicitly separates efficiency from power maintenance. Sun Tzu's domain is efficiency. How do you achieve your objective with minimum waste? That's a question about systems, logistics, positioning, intelligence. Machiavelli's domain is power. How do you maintain your position in a world where fortune is hostile and other actors are not trustworthy? That's a question about reputation, leverage, decisive action.
The contamination happens when you let one domain's logic leak into the other. You use Machiavellian power moves to solve an efficiency problem, and suddenly, you've alienated the partners you need for long-term positioning. Or you use Sun Tzu efficiency thinking to solve a power problem, and you're standing there optimizing processes while someone else takes your job.
A practical heuristic, when you're making a strategic decision, ask yourself two separate questions. Question 1, what's the most efficient path to the objective? That's your Sun Tzu answer. Question 2, what's required to maintain my position regardless of what fortune throws at me? That's your Machiavelli answer. They might align, they often won't. The discipline is not letting one answer swallow the other.
Most strategic failures I've seen come from conflating those two questions. The team that optimizes for efficiency and forgets that a reorganization is coming. The leader who focuses entirely on maintaining power and lets the underlying operation rot. You need both lenses, but you need to know which lens you're looking through at any given moment.
If you only remember one thing from this whole conversation, make it this. Sun Tzu is for when you can afford to be patient. Machiavelli is for when you can't. The skill isn't picking one and sticking with it forever. The skill is knowing which clock you're on.
Even with those tools in hand, there's a bigger question. As AI systems increasingly make strategic decisions, not just recommending, but actually executing, whose philosophy are they going to encode? Right now, the people building these systems are mostly engineers optimizing for whatever metric they've been handed. They're not sitting in a room debating whether the system should be Sun Tzu or Machiavelli. They're just implementing.
The implementation isn't neutral. A reinforcement learning agent trained to maximize market share in a simulated competitive environment is going to develop Machiavellian behaviors by default. Because the simulation is a zero-sum world where fortune is hostile and other agents are untrustworthy. It's the prince as a training environment.
If you deploy that agent in a real market where long-term relationships matter, where reputation compounds, where you have to live next to your competitors afterward, you've just automated a strategic mismatch at scale.
The alternative is equally tricky. If you train an AI to be pure Sun Tzu, always looking for the efficient path, always avoiding direct confrontation, you might build something that's great at positioning and terrible at recognizing when the situation has become zero-sum and decisive action is required.
A Sun Tzu AI in a Machiavelli moment gets eaten. A Machiavelli AI in a Sun Tzu market burns the ecosystem down. Neither outcome is theoretical. We're going to see both.
Here's the thing nobody's talking about. These systems won't just encode one philosophy or the other. They'll encode whatever philosophy was implicitly baked into their training data and reward functions. Which means the strategic assumptions of a few dozen engineers in San Francisco could end up shaping decisions that affect millions of people.
The best strategists know when to be Sun Tzu and when to be Machiavelli. But more importantly, they know the difference. And the question we haven't answered yet is whether an AI can learn that difference, or whether it'll just optimize for whatever philosophy it was born into.
That's the open question I think Daniel's prompt is really pointing toward. Not just what's the difference between these two thinkers, but how do we build systems that can think clearly about which framework applies when?
Because the alternative is a world where our strategic decisions are being made by systems that have never read either book, don't know what they're assuming, and can't tell you why they chose ruthlessness over patience, or vice versa.
That's not strategy. That's just fast automation of inherited bias.
Thanks, as always, to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for making this show possible.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show.
We'll be back with another one soon. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, Russian settlers around Lake Baikal consumed a fermented fish preparation called sour omul, produced by burying freshly caught omul in birch bark containers lined with wild garlic and leaving them to undergo lactic acid fermentation in the permafrost for 6 to 8 weeks. The resulting paste contained approximately 12% lactic acid by weight and was eaten as a winter protein source despite its ammonia-heavy aroma.
Right, right.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.